a speaker meeting. Alex will speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Donna, who will share her experience, strength, and hope. It's all you.
My name's Alex. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Alex.
I guess I will stand up. Man, I know once I start, I won't be able to stop talking, but starting is always the hardest part. Right off the bat, I grew up in Seattle, Washington, in a small town right outside of Seattle. I won't go too much into, childhood or anything, but I just want to say that growing up, I was around a lot of alcoholism. I didn't really think it was too dysfunctional. It was more like the redneck, get drunk and shoot guns in the woods kind of like alcoholism, which when I was younger, I thought was like kind of fun. I didn't think that there was anything wrong with getting drunk and, just being ridiculous and blowing up shit in the woods. I also didn't really know anything different. So growing up, I saw a lot of like relatives and family members get blacked out and drunk, and it was always like kind of any sort of family get together, like, who was going to get wasted and make an ass of themselves. You probably talk about that for a couple months until like the next get together, and then whoever else made an ass of themselves was then who you talk about until the next get together. So growing up, I had a kind of skewed view of like alcohol. I didn't realize that not everyone got blacked out all the time, and that, people were able to do things like fish or watch TV without whiskey and beer, And I never drank normally either. The first time I ever got drunk was off a homebrew my brother and I made in our closet when I was like 12. I don't think that's very normal. We found out that although my family were big drinkers, kids weren't allowed to drink, so we found out you didn't have to be any age to buy homebrew supplies. So we went to this wonderful store called Homebrew Heaven in the little town I live in and got champagne yeast and a bunch of apple juice and were wasted. And it kind of went from there. Like, that kind of set the tone for, like, my drinking. It was never normal. It was never moderated. It was never, like not getting drunk was never even the goal. Most people, I don't know what happened. I got drunk last night. I didn't try to. Mine was like, I didn't get drunk last night. I tried to. What the fuck happened, So that was kind of setting the tone for disaster. Alcoholism took me to, I always used to think that you had to be an alcoholic. Or to be an alcoholic, you had to be homeless and, like, living under a bridge, drinking out of a brown paper bag. And I always thought, I had a job and a decent place and a car, so I couldn't be an alcoholic. Well, later on down the road, I was that guy drinking out of a brown paper bag underneath a bridge, But it took a long time to get there, so I didn't really see it coming. And I got really also involved in drugs. That's a big part of my story. I also started manufacturing a lot of drugs. I used to make a lot of morphine and mescaline and stuff like that. And that kind of, I never knew how to do anything normally. I always like dove head first. I was ordering like poppies from all over the country. I was ordering like San Pedro from Mexico and all this stuff. And I thought that like I couldn't be an alcoholic or an addict because I was some kind of like scientist, Like I thought I was like, I would like, read like a lot of, out there books. And like I'm like a Hunter S. Thompson, even though I never really progressed past like doing a Google search for make drugs. That was like about like, and some chemistry classes. That's about like where I stopped at. I never drank normally, but I don't think I ever lived normally either. When I was younger, like there was this parking garage in Seattle that said, please pay attendant when on duty. And I noticed there was never an attendant there. So I went to Goodwill and I got like a windbreaker with a little corporate logo on it. I was then a parking attendant. I treated it like a job. I'd be like, I'd be like, man, it's Seahawks game. It's going to be a busy night at work, And saying things like that now, like, I have to laugh because it didn't seem ridiculous to me at the time. But, looking back, I'm like, what the fuck was I thinking? And eventually, obviously, it stopped being quite as fun and stopped being like, I surrounded myself entirely with alcohol and drugs. I worked in bars. I got into music when I was really young, so I played a lot of music. I played a lot of shows. I worked in a lot of bars and restaurants. So work and everything, you know, surround restaurants, people get drunk all the time at work, you know. My friends all got drunk. When you play shows, like, you always get drunk. You bring beer to band practice. So every part of my life, I made sure that, like, no one would ever have anything to say about me drinking or getting high. And, you know, it worked for a while, and then eventually things started, you know, to fall apart. I went from, like, having a really nice apartment, and I managed to go to school and collect a couple degrees and, like, get a couple good jobs, but that slowly just, like, all fell away. I went from having a really nice apartment and, like, a really nice car to, like, an all right apartment and, like, an all right car to, like, a really shitty apartment and, like, a beater to, like, just renting a room to a bicycle. And, like, eventually I was under a bridge. I was in and out of jail. And, you know, one of the times everyone was fed up with my shit and I had nowhere to go. And I ended up living under a bridge for quite a while. And I really didn't even see a problem in that. You know, I was looking around and I was like, this is a fucking nice bridge. You know? And my thing was like, why pay like $400 a month rent on a room when you can live under like a $4 million bridge? Like, and you know, but I you know, either would rob people or shoplift to get money. And you know, it started, I was homeless in San Francisco in the Tenderloin, and then I ended up homeless in Pleasanton, of all places. And not because I knew Pleasanton, but because Santa Rita was right there, and they kept taking me back there. So eventually I just stopped leaving. You know, I just stayed right there. You know, but eventually I ended up collecting enough serious stuff where I was facing some really long prison time. For home invasion. And that's where it kind of, you know, was a cold slap reality there. I was going to get 12 years for a home invasion, and I was 25 at the time. And, like, that's what it was, just like, fuck, you know, I'm going to be 37 by the time I get out of prison, you know, and I already had a strike. And, you know, that was kind of where the judge gave me, I did 9 months. I got really lucky, and they said I needed to do 6 months in a program or go to prison. So I was like, I better believe I'll take this program. And the program I went to, I'm starting to think maybe the prison would have been better, because, like, it was this really fundamental, like, right-wing Christian program. And, you know, I remember, like, I had a Stephen King book in my room, and I was reading, like, the Dark Tower series, and the director found it in my room and brought me in the office all serious. I'm like, why are you bringing Satan in this house? I was like, what the fuck? Like, oh, my God. You know, but even that, I can look at, like, everything I went through, and it was what I had to go through to get me where I'm at now. And, you know, now what my life is like now, like, I have a much more rewarding life than I ever thought I would. I work full time. I have a boss that trusts me and actually wants me to show up at work. You know, it used to be like, fuck, Alex showed up to work. Now it's like, damn it, Alex didn't show up to work. You know, like, I actually have people that trust me to be there, and they can rely on me to be there. And there are times where, you know, my boss sends me to, like, you know, to Home Depot with his truck and, like, thousands of dollars on a Home Depot card, and, like, he can trust me to come back. Because before, like, I would not be coming back. Like, I'll take your truck, you know, like, yeah. I'll buy a lot of shit at Home Depot, but I'm not coming back here, you know, like, and it's completely different now. You know, I go to school full-time, and I also work part-time as a drug and alcohol counselor out in Hayward. You know, that's something I never thought I'd be able to do. I used to think that even though I'd gone to school before, I was like, man, people, like, with this many felonies, or people with this, that were homeless for that long, like, don't go back to school. They don't get decent jobs. They don't do this. And, like, I really sold myself short, because I just, like, put that stamp of, like, homeless addict on me. And, like, that's what I was living up to in every way. Like, if you expected a homeless person to do something, I would do that. You know, like, my social skills, like, included throwing up in public and yelling at people. That was, like, about it. And, you know, today, like, it's so different. Like, sometimes I have to, like, you know, wake up and, like, remind myself, like, this is my life, because it seems, like, too good sometimes, you know? Like, in all reality, like, I should be sitting in prison, you know, for another, like, 10 years. You know, I should be, you know, still out there drinking. Like, all odds were against me, and it was only because of this program, really, and a couple other things that I was able to get any sort of, like, semblance of a normal life. One big thing for me was, like, I'm definitely dual diagnosis, where I have, like, severe anxiety and depression. And I was, like, I just used to pour alcohol on it. You know, I used to never want to look at that. And today, like, I can say I have a therapist, and I go talk to a therapist because although I'm a counselor and I do all these things, I'm also a fucked up person. I need someone to talk to because life gets fucked up sometimes, and I don't have to drink over it, you know. I used to have to drink over pretty much anything, and I kind of use this as an excuse, like, I missed my bus, let's get a 40 while I wait for the next one. Or, you know, like, cash in on the carpet, we need a fifth. You know, like, anything, and I was drinking. But, you know, like, I actually just found out today that, you know, I don't keep in touch with my family very much because, you know, they're all junkies and alcoholics, and they're just toxic. But I found out my mom had to have, like, open abdominal surgery for, like, bowel resectioning or something, whatever the hell that means. It sounds serious, you know? And I'm assuming she's doing all right because she posted it on Facebook, so I don't think she's like ill. But you know, like, I didn't have to drink over that, and that's an amazing thing because, you know, that is something serious. You know, I was one of those people that had a lot of, you know, ifs when I first got sober. Like, if this happens, I'll get wasted. Like, if something happens to my parents, even though I mostly hate them, like, it was just something I held on to because I was like, yeah, most people say that. If my parents die, I'm going to drink. So that's a good one for me. You know, or if this happens. And, you know, a lot of those ifs have come up, and I haven't had to drink. Yeah, so I think that's about 10 minutes. But thank you.
Hi, I'm not an alcoholic and addict. Thank you, Alan, for that intro. I'm born and raised in Philadelphia. Philly girl, tough girl, from, you know, very, very dangerous part of Philly. You know, you had to be tough to walk the streets there and to survive. I grew up in a very alcoholic family. Long line of alcoholics. You know, I don't really have any secrets about my family. My cousin, half my family's in the mafia. I try not to really talk about it, but it's kind of on the front page news right now, so I don't really have much of a choice. You know, I'm hoping that bad Joey gets his act together and decides to go straight. You know, I got a good Joey and a bad Joey in my family, and I guess you can guess which one, you know, I don't really want to be like. You know, so my family is, they're a great family, actually. They really are. They're a cast of characters. And one reason why I love AA meetings, I mean, we're all characters in here, and alcoholics are very interesting people to me. And, you know, being one myself, I do nothing normally. I don't drink coffee normally. I don't eat normally. I don't drink normally. I don't use drugs normally. You know, I always use in excess, you know. And so it's pretty apparent to me at a young age that, like, I was different, you know. And I wanted to get out of Philly really early, you know. Like, I saw these crazy people and my uncle drinking out of a glass, you know, that looked like coffee, but it was vodka. And I was like, oh, yeah. I got to get out of this family, you know. My uncle was the pedophile, and I was very lucky I didn't get raped by him, but I heard cousins that did, and I was just like, oh, yeah. Whenever he called me upstairs, I was like, yeah, that asshole, yeah, I'm going up there. You know, and it's like, you know, my own survival mechanism kept me from these people for whatever reason. You know, I remember one time him saying, oh, yeah, come upstairs with me. And I was like, I got up there, and then he, like, pulled some nudie books out, and I was like, oh, yeah, shit. Like, this is not the place to be, you know. But I heard other cousins talk about him, and was like, yeah, you got to stay away from that guy. That guy's crazy. I was just like, you know. I heard his story once, and I believe it, you know, that he had touched my sister, and my uncles, like, put him in a room and held a gun to his head and said, if you touch anybody in this family again, you're dead. You know, they sent them off to the Merchant Marines. I wish people dealt like that in real life sometimes. You know, like, okay, get rid of the mother. You know, so, you know, I'm just explaining to you that my family is pretty crazy, and I'm pretty lucky that, like, I don't have anger issues anymore, and I don't choose to deal with people that way. I started drinking 13. My sister asked me to be in her wedding. I was like, I'm not going to wear a dress. That's all there is to it. She's like, you got to wear a dress. I'm like, well, I'm not. I'm not going to wear a dress. So, Yeah, I think she's still pissed that I didn't. But she's in the program now, so I think she's probably gotten it over by now. Instead, I got drunk on slow gin and threw up. And from that moment on, I really liked that feeling, and I chased after it. I chased after it at every moment I could. Had my first drug soon after that. You know, the gateway drug, pot. And from pot went to, you know, I'm a 70s kid, so like it was barbiturates all the way. You know, it was Dilaudids and Paxils and Quaaludes, and I had Quaaludes, you know. And I really liked all those two little, you know, I think about it now, and all those were just like a way of like really passing out and not being part of, not having to feel feeling, not having to think about my family, not have to deal with that fucking high school I went to where everybody listened to the Grateful Dead. I was like, what the hell are you doing? The worst fucking music. Grateful Dead, Leonard Skinner. You know, I'd go to Philly, and I was like, you know, like we moved to Jersey later on, and Jersey is and Philly, they're like across the bridge, just like Oakland and San Francisco. So like, I would go to Philly and go hear punk bands in the 70s, and I just thought, yeah, this is where I'm at. Like, this is the unks. This music speaks to me. Not these motherfuckers sitting there going, you know, playing for 20 minutes. It's just like, you know, the drugs were all wrong. You know, but I appreciate the Hunter S. Thompson thing. Because, like, all my heroes back then were, like, Hunter S. Thompson, Jack Kerouac. But there were no women, you know. It's like, geez, okay. Couldn't really like be a girl and follow Jack Kerouac, so like all my heroes suddenly became like Joan Jett and like all the rocker chicks, you know. And I was like, I want to be like that. So my friends came out to San Cruz, and I thought it would be a great idea to follow them. And I called one time. This was like typical New Jersey / East Coast. Like in the summertime, we would all pile in a car, get loaded, get down to the shore. And we call our parent, hey, I'll see you in September. Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, my mom, you can hear her screaming, what are you here? You know, and we all get jobs and be loaded the whole summer, you know, have just a blast. And then this time, like, I called and I was like, yeah, I'm going to California, you know, and she was just like livid, you know. And I had a boss at the time. My best friend's grandfather owned his plumber place, and I was the assistant, his assistant. We'd always go drinking for lunch. Like, we'd have, like, I loved him because he could never remember my name. He called me Maisie. And we'd have, like, a martini lunch. I'd come back and I'd go to the books. He'd go, Maisie, I think you're off on the books here. I'd be like, oh, yeah, okay, I'll get to it tomorrow. So I called Mr. Jordan in California. I was like, hey, Mr. Jordan, I'm going to be off for a while. He's like, okay, Maisie, we'll find somebody else. And then I stayed there for the summer in Santa Cruz. And I was supposed to marry my boyfriend, who's in the Navy. And I thought that was a great idea. And then, you know, I was like, I just should just go. I was going to college. I actually graduated high school. Don't ask me how. Graduated high school. I did a year of college. Then I think, well, I'll go switch and go in Santa Cruz. And I went to, like, the campus of Santa Cruz. I was like, oh, yeah, this is, like, too hippy-dippy for me. They got a slug as a mascot. This is, yeah, this is too Grateful Dead for me. Yeah, I'm not going to know school like that. So, you know, I start partying with all these bands. And I was like, well, I'm just going to open a punk club. So I decided to stay in Santa Cruz, and I opened a punk club. And don't ask me how, why, you know. That's what I did. And, it, you know, at the time it was great because there are all these drugs, you know. You had to do a lot of drugs. And, of course, I didn't think there was anything wrong with my drinking because, like, I just did so many drugs it didn't really even matter. Like, you know, I could just stay awake longer, you know. I thought that my problem was barbiturates. So long as I didn't do any barbiturates, I was fine, you know. Shit went downhill really quick in Santa Cruz, and I went a little crazy, 5150, this place called Emmeline. I called it Emmeline and the Pines. I just thought, well, I'll just have a little vacation, go to Emmeline, you know, go to this little crazy house, and, you know, so I stayed there for a while, and then I came out, went to a crisis house, and then I went to a program called Sunflower House, And it was connected with Synanon at that time. They weren't integrated with 12-step programs. I remember sitting on the bench, and I heard somebody talking, and they said John Lennon was killed. So it was December 11th, like, I don't know, whatever year, 1982? There you go. Okay, so, you know, I got accepted into Sunflower House. He's talking about that rehab place. Man, this place was just like, they call it a haircut. You did something wrong, they put you in the room, they start screaming at you, right? They're like, you, and they like curse at you. Like, and they're like, why are you, motherfucker? You know, they thought that, like, that was going to help you stay. You know? And there was this guy, he was from New York, this Brooklyn guy, and they used to come through your room while you were sleeping and check on you and then mark you off. And this one night, this guy, he grabs me. He says, hey, come with me. I go out, and there's two other guys, and they grab me from both sides, and they're grabbing me. And then this other guy comes. Next thing I know, the police are there. This guy grabs the other guy, holds the gun to him, and is like, hey, let her go. And then later on, I find out that they were going to, like, take me into, like, some prostitution. And, you know, so I was very lucky. Yeah, I mean, these were hardcore criminals. I was like the only one of the few, one of the only women there did not have quote unquote like a criminal background. You know, I went on in on my own accord. These places were serious back then in the 70s, you know, like there was no shit. Like, there was some, you were thrown in with serious criminals. You had no idea what they did, you know. Which is fine, you know, it kept me sober. We had this thing, it was called, if the house was dirty, which meant, like, if people were holding secrets, everybody would sit on a floor, and everybody had to cop to their shit, they called it. Like, anything you did wrong. So, like, you know, it's like, you're like, sitting there, you're like, what the fuck did I do wrong, you know? And I'm like, I don't know what the fuck I did wrong. Okay, so I thought badly. So I'm like, in a house, you can't do anything. So what could you possibly do wrong? I remember I went to this movie with this woman named Connie who killed her husband. She poisoned him. That's why she was there. So we went to see this movie called Atlantic City with Burt Lancaster and Susan Sarandon. And there is a scene where Susan Sarandon is like ripping like lemons off her chest. And, like, it's, like, kind of a sexual scene. And Connie leans over and she says, honey, when we get out of here, it's going to be me and you. And I'm like, right. Poison. I was like, yeah, Connie. So I remember rubbing her hand and going, yeah, Connie, sure, whatever you want. And then we're sitting there. Connie's in the other room giving up my shit saying, oh, yeah, she, like, made this big play for me. And I'm like, I'm sitting there, and the counselor's yelling at me, you knew you did this, and we got somebody else in the other room, you better cop to your shit. I'm like, I don't know. They're like, okay, you're leaving, because we got some shit on you. Then I found out later that Connie had, like, totally had made up this story. True, like, we did kind of, like, I don't know, what do you call the word? Intrigue. We intrigued. Whoa! We intrigued. Wow. No. Oh, you couldn't call what's called war storying either. War storying is like when you get together and you talk about drugs and you glorify it. And I remember Connie and I had glorified the drug use, you know, and talked about, yeah, well, we did this. You know, so she had given up these two things. So I got kicked out. I was still sober. Went back, found a place to live, keeping my crap together pretty well, you know, and I was just like, yeah, barbiturates, just can't do those things. And then my father passed away. I lasted as long as I could, and then, boom, as soon as the first opportunity came up, I didn't have much of a sound foundation. And when the opportunity came up to pick up a drink, I did, and then to pick up a drink and then a drug, it was no problem. So pretty much downhill, I was doing a lot of punk shows then, and pretty much went downhill really quick, which is a good thing, you know, because I'm not sure if I would be alive. My last using was, yeah, this is a crazy story. You know, like, I was not a heroin addict. I didn't like needles. I'm a Virgo. I'm, like, really anal about that kind of crap. But I partied with Jeff Raphael from the Nuns, and he wanted to go cop some drugs, and I thought he was copping coke, but he was copping heroin. went and did heroin, and then he was like, he didn't have any needles. I'm like, well, I'm not doing heroin with you. So then, I wound up getting my own needles, and then I went on a fucking binge for like 2 weeks and ended up in the Del Mar in Santa Cruz with somebody I didn't know. Looked at the paper the next morning. It's, Rock Hudson had died. It was October 2nd, 1985. And I just said, shit, I'm going to die like that, if I don't get sober. And I called one of my best friends up and I said, you got to help me here. Like, I'm going to die. I don't really want to die. My life had no hope at that moment, where you just know, you're just in the sure. Here I'm 26 years old and really, I feel older than I do now. I went into a 21-state program, went to meetings, and just remember the first year, just so much stuff, so grateful to be sober that I would have done anything. Working at Lipton's, making no money, it didn't really matter, I was really like one of those people. Once I got sober, I just was like, I was willing to do anything except the life that I did before. And I did the program the best of my ability, did the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, had sponsees. By the time I hit 13, got a tattoo. Oh, yeah, I'm 13 years sober. I don't really need to go to meetings anymore. Just like that typical, I'm sure a lot of people go through that. Life is to experience, it's not to really go to meetings anymore. Those people were just, they're addicted to meetings. And that was like the whole little thing that I told myself. At 13 to 16, I was just really stubborn. I made my job, I was a workaholic, I made my job my higher power and worked my ass off. By the time I was, 19 years sober, I got married, had a kid, who's 10 now. And thankfully, about 7 years ago, I had various times in sobriety, I've had spiritual awakening. Had a spiritual awakening then that was pretty harsh. I just was really miserable in my marriage. Didn't have a whole lot of friends that were in the program, that I really hung out with. I really worked my ass off so much. I just didn't have a concrete life connected to the program. I decided to end the marriage, and that was really hard because it was just this guilt thing of, I'm doing something that's really detrimental to my child. But I'm doing it for myself because all I'm thinking of is how can I max out a credit card and go away and never come back, because I can't drink and I definitely don't want to kill myself. And I went to a therapist and I told her, and she's like, yeah, I would say that was the same thing. You basically want to get on a plane and just leave and just never come back. And I was like, okay, well, that's not really a good idea, And I thought about it, and I was like, yeah, I'm just escaping. I'm just doing the same thing, with drugs and alcohol, except I'm not really killing myself, So that was a spiritual awakening, and I started going to meetings, and I split up my relationship. And, at the time, it was a really hard thing to do. Thank God I had the program. And, my friends that were my friends before I got married were still there for me. Nobody was like, I told you so, that woman was a bitch. Nobody did that. I didn't do that. I was just like, we're just not compatible. We just can't do this. I didn't do the bitter partying one, which is no fun, really. If you've ever done bitter partying one, how dreadful it is. Everybody's looking at you and they're like, yeah, you're not miserable. keep telling yourself that. So at the meetings, and I got a sponsor, and I realized going back to meetings that most of my male friends had died of AIDS in the 80s, and that I didn't have any gay male friends anymore because I was really scared of getting close to a gay man again. and having them die. And so, you know, I found myself going to gay male meetings and being like, boom, pushed up against all these gay men who still had AIDS but were surviving. And like, wow, why am I fucked up after these meetings and crying, you know? And then lo and behold, had discovered that, yeah, I had a lot of grief because I worked so hard before, that I was a workaholic, that I wasn't really in contact with any of those feelings. You know, I'm definitely a believer that this is a long program, and I don't want to scare anybody, because I am truly in the belief that it's just 24 hours. You know, Mindy and I were chatting right before the meeting, and she's like, oh yeah, you got 29 years now. You know, I just think that I got 24 hours. You know, because if somebody gave me that plan when I came in here and said, this is what you're going to do at 10, 15, 16, 19, I'd go, fuck you, really? I'm out of here. You know? It would have been crazy. You know, the past few years have been the most challenging. I don't even want to use the word hard, because it really is truly life's on life's terms. You know, my mom died in sobriety. I didn't pick up. You know, yet another heartbreak didn't pick up. You know, just crazy shit, you know? My brother, like, slammed his door in my face after my mom died, said, guess we don't have to ever see each other again since mom's dead. Like, yeah, fuck you. That's a real nice thing to say. We both lost our mom, and that's what you say to me? You know, and I had to realize that when I did my fourth, fifth, and sixth, that he had deep hurt. His hurt was different than mine. We all come from the same family. We interpret it different, is the way I look at it now. You know, like, my sister's in the program, and whenever we talk about family, it's different. You know, and at first I used to say, God, she drives me crazy. Like, she had it perfect, you know? And then she's over there going, oh, yeah, she was the baby, man. Mom and Dad didn't do crap when she came along. Yeah, great. You know, so, like, I had all this, like, anger and resentment of, oh yeah, I was a Dr. Spock kid, and she's like, you know, the high achiever, right? You know, so like, now when we talk, I have to say it's totally different. Like, there's not this tension there used to be. I used to get on the phone with my sister and be like, oh, I have to talk to my sister. And sometimes I'd break up in tears because I had so much stuff built up. I remember one time, it must have been easily 10 years ago, we were driving, she came and visited, and me and my daughter were in the car, my niece was in the car, and we're driving. My sister decided to start a heavy conversation about my mom, who was extremely depressed growing up. And my sister says, yeah, well, mom wasn't unhappy. And I'm like, yeah, well, she was depressed, she didn't get help. And she's like, oh yeah, she wanted to be that way. And I, like, automatically step back, and I'm like, yeah, well, that's my mom. Don't you dare talk to her like that. And then I'm like crying, and, you know, I'm really upset. Those don't happen anymore. Thank God. We haven't had one of those in a long time, in a really long time. And I think a lot of it has to do with how I've changed. How I've changed is we have the same parents, and we have different interpretations of what that was like, you know, and that's fine. It's true. Our truths are the same. Whatever we each went through, they're the same. I have to say, my best friend says, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. You know, and the honest to God truth is, like, you know, I can say a lot of successes in my life, but I've never picked up. You know, and to me, that really truly is the most humbling of success stories, is to not have picked up. You know, interesting financial stuff in the past few years. You know, had to go on GA, had to go on disability, wound up getting some crazy ass immune deficiency disease, which thank God it's in remission now. And, you know, I used the meetings and the program around having that, and basically just really meditated a lot and prayed a lot, and really just took that one day at a time. And it really was the only way I could take it, because I didn't know what was going to happen. I had no comprehension, like, what it would mean. You know, I'd always worked, and I thought, wow, like, my entire, the way I looked at myself and self-esteem was affected once I couldn't work anymore. And I really had to look at that and validate myself on a whole other level, which was different of that, hey, it doesn't matter. You know, I had to volunteer more. You know, I still don't know if I'm ever going to work again, you know, and I really don't care. I think that's the difference now. I did really care before, and I was really wrapped up in it, and it was really like, it was part of my whole, how I looked at myself and viewed myself, you know, and part of it in the past few years about not working in clubs anymore, and not booking bands and doing a whole different job was that I wasn't cool anymore. I didn't want to be cool. I just wanted to be a regular person. You know, like I didn't want people to like me because I did this. I wanted people to like me because I was truly a cool person just to be, just like naturally, you know. And that's, you know, that's been a new thing to just be a mom and to have people go, hey, you're a good mom, and me to go, I'm a good mom, because I constantly hear that I'm not a good mom from my co-parent, and, you know, and that's been hard, too, so, like, if anybody's here and they're dealing with those type of issues, you know, there's hope, there definitely is hope, you know, taking the high road is always, is definitely always the route to take, in my opinion. You know, it causes a lot of shit to do the other thing. I know my previous sponsor, I have a new sponsor in the past year and a half, and my other sponsor used to always say, because she moved, and said, whenever I would get into some kind of drama situation, she would say, what did you do to co-create? And now when I think about it, I'm like, yeah, I didn't even co-create it. I created it, you know. It's apparent that I created it, you know, like I didn't have to be there. You know, I'm working on a 6-step right now, and it's hard to, like, go, oh, yeah, I gossiped today, and to, like, sit at the bus stop. She's like, yeah, when you're at the bus stop, just think about what you did and ask God to make yourselves more willing and to take those character defects away. Well, you know what? I don't think they're ever going to be taken away. I think the shine might be less shiny, and, you know, possibly I will be not as boisterous as I normally am. I mean, some of it's cultural, you know? Like, I'm Italian. Like, what did you expect? You expected me to be quiet? I don't think so. Like, we had to, like, we had a dinner on Sundays. There was, like, a table from there to there. I always had to eat in the kitchen, you know, because there's never room. You had to wait till somebody died to go eat. So, you know, to even have your voice heard, you had to be loud, you know. So it's not even in my jeans or my makeup, you know. So, like, the fact that I don't scream across the room when I see somebody I know or go, yo, hey, how you doing? Like, that to me is, you know, that progress, not perfection, you know. I'm a firm believer in progress, not perfection. You know, so if you're sitting in here and you're like, yeah, I still do this, you know what? You're probably still going to do it in 10 years from now. You know? If you don't pick up a drink or a drug and you're aware of that thing and you do it less and you know your modus operandi, more power to you. You probably have a better understanding of what that thing is that makes you tick, and, you know, you won't drive yourself as crazy, you know, because half of it's really about driving yourself crazy, and then on top of that, then you drive everybody else crazy, you know. You know, I hear a lot of people, my friends, they'll go through this thing. I mean, classic friend of mine last week was like, I'm so lonely. I'm like, okay, I'm really sorry if you feel lonely, okay? Yeah. Well, you know what? Most of human beings feel lonely at some point or time. Get a cat. Sorry. Processing. You know, don't get involved in a relationship. But this used to be me. I'd be lonely, and then I get in a relationship. You know? That didn't work. You know, that was problematic. You know, I got a cat, actually. It's actually less, it is less problematic. People are nice. You know, it's nice to be able to go to a meeting, whether or not you know people in it, and to have the common ground of being an alcoholic in recovery. Whether or not We like one another. That old, you might not like me, but you'll come to love me. You know, when I did get sober in Santa Cruz, it was with a bunch of old men that were smoking cigarettes. And y'all are so lucky for me to walk in a room like this and to see so many young people. That's amazing, because you all get to go out and go see a band together and be sober. You know, when I moved to San Francisco, my posse of people were all of us going to an Avengers show or going to Nina Hagen or going to DV8, and it was a sober group of people, and it was fucking rad, you know? And the fact that half of those people are still here and still sober is, you know, is heartwarming. You pick up the paper, and you see people killing each other, I can guarantee you, like, 9 out of 10 of those people are not sober. In the craziest of my times, that is when I did the crazy shit that I did. You know? When you're on bath salts, that's when you try to rip somebody's face. Yes. You do not do that shit sober. You might do some crazy ass shit. You know, you might be hungry and walk into Safeway and steal steak or something. You know, you're not gonna like do some wacky ass thing that you're like, whoa, that is crazy. Like, when you hear somebody running some story that's spinning, you're like, man, what is that person on? You know, and it's true. Sadly enough, like, a lot of people are on drugs. And so I think we're the lucky ones. We're here, you know, we're sober. I don't care. If you want to think that we're in a cult, great. You know, I think we're in the best cult you could be in. Yeah. We're in a pretty damn good cult. So, I don't know, am I done?
Do you have a little bit more time? You have, like,
oh, okay.
5 minutes, you know, if you want, but it's up to you.
I mean, I have to say, I really, really am grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous and people in the rooms, because these are the people that when I have wanted to use, I've called you up. And I got to say, not too many people have hung that phone. You know, I can't actually think of one time I've called somebody that picked up the phone, except nobody picks up the phone now, right?
Right.
So you text them. You know, you text them. Hey, are you awake? Can you talk? You know, and I just got in town, like, was away for a month with my daughter, and we got to go visit my family and do some fun things. And when I got home, an old friend of mine had passed away. And sadly, somebody did not get this program, you know. I think he tried a few times, like some of my friends have. And, you know, I still keep those people at arm's length, because I see them come into program and get a chair here. And, you know, that's always a heartwarming thing when you see somebody that you know that gets sober, you know. And I saw this one fellow that I'd known for quite a few years, and I kept at arm's length. And I love this guy dearly, but I was like, yeah, I can't hang out with him. Like, he's a blackout drunk, you know. And then he went in the Davies and had a liver problem, and I visited him in the hospital, and he asked me to take him to a meeting. It was heartwarming to see him get 2 years. My friend that passed away in August, you know, like, he's a great guy, you know, but never thought he had a drinking problem. And, you know, it's not really my place to tell you, but I don't think I'm really going to hang out with you either, you know? It's going to be uncomfortable. So, you know, sometimes we're going to get shit out there, you know, because people are going to say, yeah, they're in the program, they're kind of standoffish, or they're this, they're that, you know? And I do get those hater reactions from people, of where people are like, yeah, whatever, her this, her that. And you really just, I'm sure you have, I know, at some point, everybody deals with this. If you have anyone in your life that drinks or uses, or a family member, and you know they probably talk behind your back, and you really have to just have to, you know, tough skin over it, really, and just pray for them. And I have to say, the thing that has saved my ass was people in the rooms that say shit about me or outside, is to pray for them. And whenever somebody comes to me with their anger and their BS, I am not perfect, but I'll tell you, I might bitch in my head about them or, you know, go off. But in the end, the thing that saves my ass is for me really thinking, I wish this person wasn't in pain. Whatever praying means to you, If it's just a simple, you know, I hope, you know, they have everything they need. You know, even if it's something as simple as, you know, I really wish them well. If you can't wish them anything else, I think it's something about taking that anger away that really gives you the power and takes it away from them. You know, so I really appreciate you 12-stepping me tonight, and I wish you a good holiday and lots of safety. Thank you.